Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways. Attention, attention. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Parlay with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. We're starting with a French theme because
Did you have hot chocolate for breakfast and croissant and that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely.
Chocolat.
Absolutely. And a Kia Royale to steady the nerve, which we'll get to in a bit.
More on that later.
Yeah. But anyway,
how are you? You all right?
Yeah, fine. Yes.
I'm a bit fatigued.
Well, you know what? This play, the Crown Jewels, it's tremendous. I'm really enjoying myself doing it, but goodness me, it's hard work. I know people go, "Thumb actors complaining about what hard work is," but we're on our feet all day, every day, and you're thinking, "Do I know my next line? Where does it come in? Oh shit!" And in fact, and obviously, we're meant to come out the other side of that, where it just happens,
like driving a car after a year.
Yeah,
you indicate because you just do.
Yeah, exactly. All that stuff. But we'll get there. But I'm in a little fried because the thing with I don't want to do the whole actors the hardest workers in the whole world thing, because everyone will immediately switch off or go to another podcast. But you're on your feet all day every day, and you're thinking, is it my line? And obviously, we're going to come out the other side of that where the scenes just happen rather
don't
than
even have to think.
Yeah, rather
it's
than
like
involve me going
a Spitfire once you've got 350 hours in your office. You just do it.
I imagine it's very similar.
There's a Messerschmitt. You just know what to do. Don't have to think. Muscle memory.
But you've been at the cricket, right? You've been at
well, yeah, I have. I've had a day of alternating fortunes because after going to see the truly excellent Spitting Image on Wednesday night, which was enormous fun, and for which huge thanks for getting me tickets, because that was brilliant. Problem. And my friend Ben loved it.
Great.
I thought that was absolutely hilarious, and I just laughed all the way through. And I particularly laughed at the rendition of Killer with Suella Braverman, which I thought was especially funny. But the whole thing was great. But then the following morning, I was overnighting at the RAF club in a little sort of single bed, which was fine. Mm. And I woke up at 5, obviously, because that's what we're doing at the moment. And so I started reading the paper, and suddenly I moved. I've torn a muscle in my back.
No.
It's unbelievably painful. So that was really annoying.
Yeah.
So I had an amazing day at Edgbaston on Friday, went up with Ned, and we watched that, and obviously the first four by Crawley and everything. Yeah. The whole day was just fantastic. But I had this really painful shoulder the whole day, so that was really annoying. And then yesterday I played cricket, and I got given out LBW by the same person for the second time in a row.
Oh, no.
Second time. And I know everyone who says their LBW isn't out, but I really wasn't on both occasions. And it's just unbelievably annoying. So I spent the whole day in pain, feeling really cross that I got out and cheaply again. Thanks to the same guy, and then we got absolutely carted. So we lost by 9 wickets. It was pretty bad. So I'm feeling a bit mixed. And then I woke up this morning at 5. My shoulder still hurt. I opened the newspaper, and there's a massive interview with my brother and Tom.
Yeah. Oh well.
Describing my parents as upper middle class, which I thought was very, very funny. I don't think my dad would have quite recognised that as his humble beginnings in Birmingham. But anyway.
Right. Oh well. Oh well. Well, I mean, the
apart
other thing,
from that, I'm absolutely fine.
Oh, good. Oh, great. Well, because there's a thing I want to talk about that's in the paper, actually, which this been this sort of kerfuffle about Douglas Bader.
Oh, yeah.
So Ben McIntyre, you know, he's got this new Colditz book, and he's been
talking
about Bader in
Colditz. Bader the Bastard.
Bader the Bastard, you know, racist, snobbish, and brutally unpleasant to anyone he considered to be of a lower socioeconomic order. And this has caused a sort of bit of a culture war skirmish, people piling on him. Because I thought everyone knew this.
This is really, really old news. Everyone knows that he was an arsehole.
It's old and cold, this news, isn't it? It's very strange.
But I remember doing this. I remember sticking my neck out about Adolf Galland and dear old Rob Schaefer got in a huff about it. And then I mentioned Bob Stanford Tuck and one of his relatives got in a huff about it.
Yeah.
These guys were alpha males. They were my way or the highway types. That's how they, you know, that's one of the things that made them such brilliant wartime leaders was their unflinching personal courage, their lack of compromise at all, and their total alpha maleness.
Yeah.
And, you know, like so many great heroes, you know, they're always flawed. And that's kind of part of the things that makes a hero kind of interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Baader was extremely arrogant. He always thought he was right. He liked being the center of attention. He had a massive ego, all those sort of things. But that's okay. You know,
exactly. The thing is, though, I think it tosses up a couple of things because, you know, we're one of the things people like, because he's been, Ben's had some flack off some off sort of conservative people. You know, he's talking Britain down. But you know, one of the things about this is the thing that really struck me yesterday thinking about it. One of the things about the Second World War is we were all in it together, even the arseholes, right?
But also,
you know what I mean?
You know, the generations of historians have been talking down Britain's wartime effort. You know, I would say on this podcast, have been championing the fact that actually Britain did pretty damn well in the Second World War.
Exactly.
But that doesn't mean to say there weren't arseholes.
Yeah, 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 exactly. We were all in it together. It included the arseholes.
It included the saints and it included the villains.
Exactly. And in a way, well, thank goodness he was on our side because Baader strikes me as a sort of fighty bloke. So if he'd been on the other side, he'd have probably been well up for it. You know, I mean, it's... Which I don't think is a denigration of him at all. I think it's very, very odd, though, this need to sort of all the people to try and, go, actually, he was okay. That's a big ball.
He really wasn't.
No, I mean, that's an enormous ball of dung you've got to roll up a hill, isn't it?
You know perfectly well that if you were sat in a pub with him and he was shooting the breeze, you'd have a fantastic evening.
Yeah.
And you'd think, oh, that was really good fun. He was hilarious. But you also know that all his anecdotes would be sprinkled with just outrageous comments that would get him cancelled in about 2 seconds. In today's world, and would probably have been quite shocking 50 years ago.
I mean,
you know, I also think I've always thought it's interesting that after the war, Galland, Stanford, Tuck, and Baader all became such mates. You know, they were kind of the school football captain types, you know. They became friends because they all recognised that fundamentally they were all the same character.
Yeah, they saw each other. Yeah, exactly.
You know, they were arrogant alpha males. You know, my way or the highway types. That's exactly what they were.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no doubt that Baader was extremely disagreeable to his Batman.
Yeah.
Because he would have seen that as a sort of sense of entitlement that in the way that people sort of talk to servants. I mean, you know, Batman is a servant, so that's how you talk to them. I mean, you know, it seems anachronistic now, when of course it is, but this is then.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that's a really interesting point because I remember reading Alex Tunzelman's history of, you know, Interwar India, and she's got this big royal tour that the future Edward VIII does, right?
Yes.
And it's the protocol that he has, right? And it's, you know, the words he needs, so gin and tonic, press my shirt. And she goes, you know, didn't include please or thank you in it. Of course not. Because you didn't say please or thank you. You say it to each other, to people of your own social standing, but you wouldn't use it for your servants. And so the idea that Baader, you know, 20 years later in a high pressure situation, is going to say please or thank you to his Batman, or what he regards as a high...
Completely. But I also find it astonishing that people are sort of slightly shocked and appalled that people have racist tendencies in the 1940s. The whole point about... What one has to understand about liberal society and about democracies is it takes centuries to get to this point, because throughout history, man has never regarded himself as equal to other man.
No.
Only now do we do so. Only now are we trying.
I mean, that's are we even trying? That's, I mean, you know, the nice pessimistic caveat. View, isn't it? You know, yeah. Every now are we even beginning to try to do it.
I just find it astonishing that people are shocked by what we would consider bad behaviour today in people in the past. I mean, you know, it's appalling that Henry VIII would want people to chop people's head off. What a barbarian. Yes, that's because he was then. Yeah. You know, that's how they did things.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's just a different time.
Well, the point is it's a different time. That's why that's the other reason it's so interesting, isn't
but
it?
But you can only get to where you are by progression. And I would still argue that the heroics of people like Baader and standing up to fascism and autocracy and Nazism and Imperial Japan and all the rest of it have helped us get to the place we are now, where we can be liberal and be appalled by that.
Well,
don't you think, to an extent?
Absolutely. Well, let's turn our attention to a different
to some other to heroes,
larger
a
than
plane.
Life character. We've both read this book. This is extraordinary.
Well, this was a recommendation of my mate Rob Gallimore, who I mentioned the other day. He of Afghan fame.
Yeah.
And he said, "Oh, you've got to read it." He said, "Did you know about the royal the Kir Royal?" I went, "No." He said, "Oh, you've got to, this amazing priest." Blah 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 blah. Told me the whole story, and I just thought, "God, that sounds absolutely amazing."
Yeah.
So then we read this book.
Brilliant book called Priests de la
very
Resistance.
Entertaining book, that's for sure.
He's, I mean, this guy's very good he's very good at naming books. Reverend Fergus Butler Galley. Loose Cannons with one N or two N's rather than three, who fought fascism in the 20th century. And it's a sort of gallop through a series of biographies of priests, vicars, canons, monks, whatever, who stood up to fascism during the Second World War and Nazism. And the characters in it, I mean, some of them are, you know, like sort of people who are in the machinery of the church doing their thing, but others are straight up resistance. And this guy, Felix Kier, is absolutely amazing, isn't he?
He's absolutely amazing. But it's prompted me to also just kind of look at, so what was the Catholic Church doing in France?
Yeah.
You know, because the dilemma, of course, for all Frenchmen is, what do you do once you're occupied? I mean, France is the only country that has this weird arrangement.
Yeah.
Of Vichy. So everyone else who surrenders, the country's overrun and, you know, the Axis forces come in and they're running the show. And they're all using local bureaucrats to do the kind of the admin. But the whole country is occupied. France is completely different because you have this totally bizarre situation where you have Vichy France and you have occupied France.
Yep.
But you still have Vichy France running the day-to-day admin of France, even in the occupied bits.
Yep.
But you have this huge third of, you know, half of France, which is unoccupied and which is in the hands of Vichy. And, you know, we've talked about this before, but you've also got
the fact that you know, there are people involved in the Vichy apparatus who see this as an opportunity to get France back on track post-French Revolution, to get to the forces of conservatism, drag France, you know, away from the excesses of the commune and all that, and get France back on track with a decent emphasis on family and patriotism and hard work and the church and Catholicism. So it's really complicated, isn't it? Or it's much more complicated because of that.
Yes, and you know, and there's a bit of form here because, of course, you've only got to look at Spain and the Spanish Civil War, where the Catholic Church comes very hard down on the side of the nationalists, of course.
Yeah.
And so you've got this notion of Catholicism and the Catholic Church being, you know, absolutely entrenched conservatism, right wing, vehemently anti-communist, all this kind of stuff. And that provokes all sorts of problems for France and for the French priesthood and the Catholic Church in France once France surrenders and you've got the kind of, you know, you've got the occupation and you've got the Vichy era. And you know, this is sort of probably, I mean, the two of the most big, the biggest, most important cardinals in France are, for example, there is Alfred Henri Maria Cardinal Baudrillard.
Yep.
And he's one of the two cardinals in Paris.
Yep.
And the other one is Cardinal Suhar, Emmanuel Suhar.
Mm.
And they are kind of sort of representative in a way of the two different takes on the
yep.
on the church in France, because yep. Baudrillard is absolutely a collaborationer.
Well,
a collaborator.
He says, priest and French, how can I, in a moment so decisive, refuse to approve the common noble enterprise directed by Germany, dedicated to liberate Russia from the bonds that have held it for the last 25 right. years, suffocating its old human and Christian traditions to free France, Europe, and the world from the most pernicious and most sanguinary monster that mankind has ever known, to raise these peoples above their narrow interests and to establish among them the holy fraternity revived from the time of the Christian Middle Ages. I mean...
There you go. So that's Baudrillard.
That's Baudrillard, you think.
Yeah.
Jeepers, mate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
and
you
he
know
and
what?
he writes that there is no contradiction between Nazism and Christianity.
It's
what the heck?
And I think this is really interesting, is it? Because given Nazism open at times hostility to Christianity, to fall for it in that way, I think is really fascinating. And
there's the three Ks, isn't there, in Nazism in the start? There's what's it? Kuka, Kinder, and Kirche.
Yeah, yeah.
The church.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's just a bluff.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but I think what's really interesting about that, though, and I think this is a thing, you know, a moment ago we were talking about then and now, about the thing that's really bothering an awful lot of people is Bolshevism. They're absolutely
100%
terrified of it, and it's a thing that's mobilized people since the Russian Revolution, since the Soviet Union establishes itself. So, you know, there's enough horror stories for the people that believe. You know, obviously there's a chunk of left wing opinion in Britain, the US, and in France that doesn't believe the horror stories come out of the Soviet Union. But there's still plenty of people who not only believe them, they think it's going to happen here. You know. And you know, he's reflecting that concern. And I think I think that often gets forgotten in a reading of people's motivations in the Second World War. That's why the Germans, after all, are able to present Barbarossa to their European partners as a crusade against Bolshevism. Yep. That's why they're able to do that, because people are that frightened of it. And I, you know, I'm not excusing him, but I think you can absolutely place him squarely in that context and understand it, you know.
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right, and I think what one has to understand is that for many people the westward spread of communism is every bit as horrendous, horrific a proposition as the westward spread of Nazism.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's painted in exactly the same light.
You know.
And it's kind of, it's dog eat dog. You know, you've got to do this, or that's what you're going to end up with.
Well, yes,
and, you know. To be fair, they've got a point, frankly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, people see. I mean, I think, you know, and it's a thing you definitely get in Britain is people see fascism, Nazism, not as an original thing, but as a reaction to that. They're not the threat itself. They're a response to the threat.
Yeah. Yes.
And. So you can see why a cardinal in the Catholic Church would end up thinking this. But so there's Baudrillard, who's the other chap?
So Baudrillard also sanctions, you know, French volunteers joining the Waffen-SS, you know.
The Legion of French Volunteers against Bolshevism.
All that.
Yeah, exactly.
All that.
Yeah.
So the other one is Archbishop Emmanuel Suhard. And, you know, he does the absolute opposite. And he's actually Baudrillard's superior. And Baudrillard actually dies in 1942. So, he never gets... And that's before the big roundups in July 1942 of the Jews. But Suhard protests openly against the anti-Semitism of the Vichy regime.
Yeah. Amazing.
So you've suddenly got, you've got two of the most senior churchmen in France taking completely opposite views.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, every parish in France has a Catholic priest, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's fair to say the vast majority of Catholic priests don't operate in to help help Jews or aren't supporting the resistance. But a fair number do.
Yeah.
And Suhard actively works to help Jews.
Yeah.
And to protest, you know, openly about the anti-Semitism laws and all the rest of it. So you know, he does his bit. But there are also, and background to that, there are some amazing characters who are in the resistance and use their position in the church to actually help them in a way that an ordinary civilian wouldn't be able to do so.
Yeah.
And Felix Kier is.
Which is how we come to Felix Kier. So I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take a break and then we'll come back to talk about Felix Kier. See you in a second.
Let James Holland take you to places in history you've never been before. The Savage Storm is the fascinating new book which brings to life the story of our Allied forces as they crossed into southern Italy in 1943. With unflinching and insightful detail, Holland places you in the heart of the action of this pivotal and brutal World War II battle. The Savage Storm is out now and available from all good bookshops.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. So James and I have just put the Catholic Church in France during the Second World War into the skip there.
Teeny bit of skip.
The thing with the French Revolution is it Juin Lai who says in 1948 or whatever, it's still unfinished business, too soon to say what the effects of the French Revolution are. Right, and apparently he's joking. It's in 1968 or something. But anyway, the point is that France is still feeling this, you know, the convulsions of the 18th and 19th century.
Yeah, yeah.
And 20th, you know.
It's 1848 as well, isn't there?
And 1871. Exactly. And the Dreyfus
Affair.
The Dreyfus Affair isn't that long ago, you know, generationally in French history isn't that long ago. So anyway, you know, you've always got to bear that in mind. Just as people want to say, oh, you know, look at what Britain was really like. Well, what France is also really like pre-war. Anyway, but Felix.
Well, yes, and let's face it, a large part of Europeans were a large number of Europeans, particularly in France, were rampantly anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
And as you say, from Dreyfus and everything, they're kind of leading the way, really.
Yeah, because it's basically baked into European culture. Anyway, that's another podcast. But so Felix Kier is this extraordinary. We want to talk about him. He's the most extraordinary man who ends up basically running Dijon for a while. But the story is absolutely incredible. So he's a priest. He's in his 60s.
Yeah, he's born in 1876, isn't he?
That's right. And becomes
a priest in 1901.
Yeah, exactly. So comes out of the seminary in 1901 and becomes very well known for being a sort of leisurely Friar Tuck figure. I mean, that's who reading about him, you think he's Friar Tuck, isn't he? He's a jolly cleric. He'll sit you down and have a pint with you or whatever
And he's got this great catchphrase, hasn't he? Because people say he says, people say to me, you know, there is no proof of God. I cannot see him. And I say to them, but you cannot see my ass, and you know it's here.
Yeah, exactly.
My dear, yeah.
But
really
but
he's, funny.
So he's a figure, a visible sort of church presence. He's a man who likes his booze. He's a man
always wears a beret.
Always wears a beret, which is very interesting. So the really important thing about Kier is he is from... He's an Alsatian, isn't he? He's an Alsatian Frenchman. Yep. And so he's grown up in the shadow of, or in the wake of, Alsace-Lorraine going to Germany and then coming back to France.
Yep.
And so his sense of Frenchness is sort of sharpened on the whetstone of that territorial dispute, isn't it? And he has a very keen sense of what it means to be French, what it means to have Frenchness taken away from you by Germany, and what it means to try and get it back. So that I think is sort of the key to understanding Felix Kier, as much as his faith, because, you know, he is a man of faith, but he's also a man of, you know, cassis and
this is his appetite. Big tipple, isn't it? So he likes white wine with cassis.
Yeah.
That's his big thing. And he never goes anywhere without his bottle of cassis to put into the white wine. And when he turns up, everyone's expected to bring the white wine out. And I'll tell you who he wrote. And then he adds a cassis and he knocks that back and he has quite a few of those. Then he'll have a bottle of red with his lunch. Then he'll go off and do something else. I'll tell you who he reminds me. I mean, he reminds me of Churchill, really.
Yeah.
In that he likes to find the things in life. He expects other people to kind of sort of rush around on his behalf.
Yeah.
He's got lots of ideas. He's brave as an ox, as a lion, and strong as an ox and all those kind of things. And he's a larger than life character, isn't he? But basically, for the first sort of 40 years of his time as a priest, he's basically done, you know, sweet FA, apart from get drunk and sort of do his priestly duties, but have a jolly nice time.
Float down the river, have a drinking. I mean, that's one of his favourite pastimes. But on 17th of June 1940, when Pétain
announces that
he's Premier of France and France is going to be occupied and all this sort of stuff, it's absolutely amazing. So the mayor of Dijon, who's a fellow called Robert Jardillier, he does the thing of filling, you know, taking the vital papers and sticking in the back of the car and
filling up the petrol, cans.
Buggering off. And Felix Kier, takes his place, makes himself mayor of Dijon.
Well, there's this little group, isn't there, of people? There's an elderly army colonel, a professor of English literature, a retired merchant navy commander, and the head of Dijon's Chamber of Commerce. And there's Felix Kier, who's now by this time a canon.
Yeah,
And basically he just kicks them all into touch and sort of acts the big man, doesn't he?
That's right. And when the Germans come to take over Dijon, he says, "Well, you're going to have to deal with me." And there's the story that he won't deal with anyone below the rank of a general.
Oh yeah, well, this is fantastic, isn't it? Because a German turns up and he walks into the office in the kind of mairie, and there's Canon Kier behind the desk, just staring at him, and he won't speak to him. So the colonel sort of goes Heil Hitler a couple of times. That doesn't seem to wash. So then he offers his hand and Kier refuses to take it.
Yep.
And eventually he says, "I'm not going to talk to anyone who's less than a general."
Yeah. Yeah. You
should have knocked before you came in. And it seems to me that kind of sort of bluster and extreme rudeness seem to kind of count for quite a lot. And because he is this canon, because he's a priest, the Germans seem curiously kind of wary of rocking the boat where he's concerned. It's bizarre, really, isn't it?
Yes, they sort of tiptoe around him a bit, and he's good at bluster and obfuscation and all this sort of stuff. But eventually, the Germans run out of patience with him, don't they?
There's this sort of interesting thing. So he gets them to make a store in the city synagogue.
Hmm.
So instead of knocking it down or burning it or whatever or destroying it, he persuades them to use it as a storehouse.
Yeah.
And takes all the kind of precious items himself and puts them under sort of lock and key and hides them.
Yeah.
So that they can't take it. And so the Germans can't burn it down because it's become a really essential storehouse for them. I mean, it just seems bizarre, the whole thing.
Yeah. And properly clever that as well.
He's constantly sort of running sort of rings around them, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, reading about this, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because obviously the Germans in France, because as we were saying before, you know, bits of France are sympathetic. The Germans in France must just never quite be sure.
Yeah, I think that's it, isn't it? That's
actually, is he on their side or is he not? Is he being helpful? Yes. Is he not? Do they need people that? Because after all, one of the problems of occupation is you need people who the locals respect and will work for and with.
Yes,
in charge, don't you? Otherwise, no one will do what you want. Because in the end, I mean, it must be very hard for the Germans to fathom actually how sympathetic people are to them. And as you know, as we've talked about long before in the podcast, until it becomes clear that the Allies are going to win, from 1943 onwards, until then, that, you know, what incentive is there for French people to resist? And obviously, you know, when the Germans try to bring all men into work for them, that changes everything.
Yes, this is the work order of June 21st, 1942. You know,
yeah, exactly.
The own goal by Pierre Laval, who is the Vichy Prime Minister.
But by the next year, by the middle of 43, you know, when it's obvious that Germany's losing, the tide's turned on that. You know, not only have they alienated all young French men of a working age, but it's obvious which way the thing's going.
Yeah,
but
up to that point, absolutely.
Yeah, but up to that point, if you're the bloke in charge of Dijon for the Germans, you're thinking, you know, maybe part of you's thinking, well, they're German anyway, because you've also at this time you've also got people going through the phone book essentially and changing people's names, Germanizing people's surnames and all that. All that nonsense is going on. Certainly into 43, they're still doing that.
Yeah.
So how you actually deal like a bloke with a fellow like Canon Keir? Because is he on your side or is he not? And it must actually be quite difficult to deal with. And also, if you know, Nazi management style is robust, rude people who boss each other about and treat their subordinates like crap. If you run into someone who's doing that as well, is he speaking your language? Yeah, exactly.
I think you've actually hit on something, because one of the things he does is there's lots of French prisoners of war at a camp at Longvik, which is just outside Dijon, and he keeps going up with incredibly official notepaper. Going up to the guards and going, you need to release these people now. And he says it with enormous authority, hands over a piece of paper, which has got all the right kind of, you know, writing on it. And they sort of go, oh, okay then. And he says, you know, I need them for kind of, you know, public works. And then they get sort of spirited away. And, you know, that's the last anyone ever sees of them.
Yeah.
And I think so you can do that by bluster and by speaking the German's language, but you can also do it in 1940 to 42, because there isn't really French resistance at that point. There is. But it's disparate. It's you know, Jean Moulin hasn't kind of sort of worked his magic at this point. Yep. It's very difficult to coordinate resistance, of course, at this time, because you haven't got WhatsApp groups and all the rest of it.
But also, you know, French morale is completely shattered. So Douglas Port makes this point that those first 2 years, you know, the French prisoners of war are essentially Germany's hostages.
Yeah.
They're being used as really powerful leverage on the Vichy government, and understandably, right? And they're being used as leverage on the French population. Do you want to see your sons again? You know, because there's millions of them in the bag.
Of course.
And also,
there literally are millions.
Literally are millions of them in the bag. And of course, Germany undergoes that weird thing where it's trying to be like a monoracial culture, and it ends up full of French people. You know and Polish people and Lithuanians and all that sort of thing. And suddenly, it's turns into this weird multiculture with vast amounts of French people in it. But Port makes the point, you know, that the blow to French morale in 1940 is completely seismic to the, you know, and to the idea of what it means to be French, and France's martial tradition and all that has been completely knocked over, and that, you know, that's a sort of national sense, but that's being felt personally by kind of everybody, you know.
Yeah.
and that you know, he's moving around in this in this environment, Keir, and able to manipulate the Germans, I think is absolutely fascinating, isn't it?
Well, he gets out about 5,000 prisoners. He manages to kind of sort of winkle out, literally, you know, effectively legally, because he just says, "You need to give them to me."
Yeah,
and the Germans, who are kind of sort of all right then,
yeah,
and they don't really quibble.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Absolutely extraordinary.
And then they finally kind of rumble him, and he's put in prison.
Yeah.
And he's sentenced to death. Then that's commuted to just sort of months in prison.
Yeah.
Then that's commuted to house arrest.
Yeah.
And I suppose from a German point of view, in these early years of the war, they're trying to do this kind of sort of, you know, we don't want insurrection on our hands. You know, we just want to kind of, you know, he's troublesome, he's a pain in the backside, but actually, you know, in the interest of sort of keeping the peace, he's such a kind of pivotal figure, he's a churchman.
But that's it. But that also shows,
it's just so weird.
But that also shows that, you know, totalitarianism is an aspiration in this situation, isn't it? It's not a reality. They obviously know that if they get rid of someone as high profile and as respected and loved as this in Dijon Dijon, in politics in Dijon, they're going to create enormous problems for themselves.
Yeah.
Or the balance of probabilities is they'll create real problems for themselves. So they do this. They, as you say, they accommodate him. They literally take him out of prison. House arrest for a man like this who's got fingers in every pie imaginable.
Yeah.
It's pretty stupid, actually. It's from their point of view.
Well, I suppose they don't want to martyr him, do they?
Yeah.
But they don't really care about sort of martyring other resistors and 17-year-old boys,
yeah,
and all the rest of it, or Jean Moulin or whoever it might be. It's funny the hold that the Catholic Church seems to have on the Germans in these, yeah, occupied countries in a way, yeah, that when you know that Hitler is vehemently anti the Church, it's bizarre, but it's what happens. And yeah, you know, he's imprisoned again briefly in 1943, sees the Allies bombing Longvik camp and a whole load more prisoners getting out. He sees that from his sort of prison cell. Yeah. But he does get released again. And he's sort of spirited away to a kind of he's not spirited away at that point, is he? Then he goes
back to his
flat in Dijon.
Yeah.
Which is quite modest.
Yeah.
And eventually the Germans decide actually the best way to do it is to get some French fascists to assassinate him.
Yeah.
Rather than having it on their own hands, so they can just say, well, it was the French who killed him. That seems to be the perfect solution.
Yeah. So who are, after all, part of the picture in certainly in 1944, this is another interesting aspect of it, isn't it? There are fresh French fascists who will do this for the Germans.
Yeah.
And who will do it for the Germans?
In January 1944.
Yeah, in January 1944. So, you know, for all the talk of how in 43 people are starting to see that, the pendulum is swinging in the Allied direction, there's still plenty of people who don't want it to. You know, and well after D-Day, there's people. Anyway, that's another story.
But this is an amazing episode because
absolutely
he's
incredible.
In the kitchen making himself some more food, and Alice Cordier, who is his housekeeper, opens the door, banging on the door, and in springs this youth with a pistol.
Yeah.
And storms it. There's a sort of, he hears a kerfuffle. Suddenly, this youth bursts into the kitchen and fires five shots and hits him twice.
Yep.
But he falls on the ground, knows he's been shot twice, but doesn't think it's very bad.
Yeah.
And knows there's another round in the chamber because he's only fired five shots.
Yeah.
So he makes a calculation. Should I sort of spring up as though I've been sort of resurrected, or do I kind of just sort of groan and wait for the coup de grace? So he takes for the former option, stands up,
yeah,
confronts the killer, and the killer is so shocked that his assassin is so shocked that he turns and flees.
Yeah.
And it turns out that he's been carrying a bundle of sort of magazines or papers in his about him. And yep, that stops the worst of the bullet, of one of the bullets, and so it doesn't pierce his heart, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so he's wounded, but he's sort of, you know, taken away and spirited away by the resistance, where he recuperates.
Yep.
And he's sort of okay. I mean, yep, it's a miracle, but it's all part of the kind of mythologizing about Canon Kier.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. And, yeah, so they, while they're fixing him up, they realize the Gestapo are onto them, and they whisk him off and hide him, don't they? I mean, it's an extraordinary story, but what then happens is when Dijon is liberated.
Yes. In September 1944.
On the 11th of September 1944, he's riding tanks into Dijon to,
yeah, he's met the column outside the city.
Yeah.
So the lead tank comes, he stops the lead tank and says, you know, I'm the mayor of Dijon, I'm the most important person here, I need to get out. So he goes on, he jumps on this tank clutching a Tommy gun.
Yeah.
And looking like a sort of something out of a Quentin Tarantino film. and is sat there in his cassock and his beret, going into you know, the head of the column of all these North African troops as they liberate Dijon. I mean, it's pure theatre, isn't it?
It's amazing. Yeah, yeah. But of course, that then makes him kind of an enemy of de Gaulle,
yeah,
who doesn't want his thunder stolen by anyone local. I think it's the most extraordinary. It's the most extraordinary story. Then he goes on to be like a politician in Dijon. You know, the rest of his life, he's completely involved in politics in Dijon, and, you know, he's the mayor of Dijon when he dies, when he's 92.
It's just absolutely incredible. He's such a dude, honestly. Anyway, so the long of it is the Kia as a drink comes from him, and the Kia Royale, of course, is the champagne with cassis, yeah, and it is named after him.
After him. So next time you're raising a glass of that, it's this incredible cleric who called the people who tried to kill him fascist fuckers for the rest of his life.
I mean, what a lad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just brilliant.
It's amazing, isn't it?
I was also very taken by the story of Abbé Pierre as well, yeah. I have to say.
Yeah.
Just, so there's this guy who's a monk, and he's a rather good-looking young youth, very sort of muscular and strong, but actually a bit sickly. So he might be a monk, and he might be sort of headed for the priesthood in his early 20s, but come the war, you know, he's called up. But actually... spends most of the time in hospital with his lung condition.
Yeah.
And despite being a Catholic monk, he's also...
quite a shagger.
He's one for the ladies. And but then does all this, starts working for the resistance. And what prompts it is the roundup of the Jews in Paris.
Yeah.
He thinks it's so appalling. He's so disgusted by this.
Yeah.
That he then sets out to help as many... Jews as possible, and he sort of shacks up with someone called Lucy Coutaz, and it's never quite sure whether they are indeed lovers, but they're certainly, if not, they have a very intense platonic relationship.
Yeah.
So read into that what you will.
Yeah.
And they have this resistance network, and again, he's being caught and then escapes. So this is a bizarre one when he has to flee to the Pyrenees. He starts setting up a kind of, you know, an escape route through the Pyrenees. Gets bounced by the Gestapo. Captured, but released that he managed to escape that same day. I mean, it's all very shady, and no one seems to be able to say how he escaped, but he did. He was sort of, either whether he was sprung from prison or whether he managed to just get out or whatever, but he did. But then later on, after the war, he then sets up this house for homeless people, doesn't he? And this charity
The other one I was really taken was with Don Pietro Papagallo, who's the forger in Rome.
Yeah.
Who basically, if you need documents, he'll do them for you.
Yeah.
And he ends up running refugees and political prisoners and POWs and everything. Yep. And it's just basically has a in his flat, he's just forging relentlessly, forging Amazing. Documents over and over and over again. And in the end, you know, they get wind of him. Someone comes in who they think that's not quite right.
Right.
And him and again, he has a housekeeper, and you know, no one knows for sure their relationship. You know, she said Maria Theresa supposedly dies in 1945 of a broken heart after he's murdered, and it's just absolutely fascinating. It's these people who just go, no, I'm not putting up. And he's the same. He thinks that this is all completely unjust. It's wrong, and I've got to do something. And you know, the documents aren't particularly good either. That's the thing. He's just churning them out. Made his own stamps. Yeah. Bang, bang, bang. It's extraordinary. Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
It does seem that the church, you know, clergymen can sort of get away with things that other resistors can't in the first part of the war. I mean, but it was, you know, I'm just sort of thinking again about the massacre of Montesole in northern Italy, you know, just south of Bologna. In September 1944, and you know, Casalia, one of these little mountain villages, you know, one of the first things they do is they just shoot the priest.
Yeah.
You know, all the people are, you know, hiding in the church, so the priest protests, so they just shoot him, you know, and that's that.
Yeah.
So that respect for the priesthood seems to be sort of disappearing by the second half of the war.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I suppose. I mean, this is one of the things that people are so brutalized by the end of the war, aren't they?
I guess so. But I also think the other thing is that the response by people and response by Germans to different situations is not linear, is it? Someone can be executed while another person can be get away from it scot-free. It just depends on the mood and the person who's in charge and the town and the circumstances and state of the war and all sorts of things. You know, they're not behaving particularly rationally, are they?
No.
Or with any sense of kind of consistency, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, there we go. A brief glance at priests. Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things I was struck by. I mean, one of the things I was struck by is actually, you know, we started this off talking about French Catholic Church. Is really in this book, he's only got a couple of examples.
Yeah,
I know it's meant it's a Europe-wide sort of look,
yeah.
But you know that anyway. It's
To
Felix Kier, well, I'll be raising a glass maybe later.
Well, let's face it. You know, we know that most people, when occupied, the most people keep their head down and just hope it'll all go away.
You
can't really blame them for that, frankly.
Well, thanks everyone for listening. On that profound moment, we'll see you all very soon.
Get off my fence and get my head down.
Yeah. Absolutely. We'll see you soon. Thanks for listening. Bye bye.
Hello, listeners. It's Anita Arnand here from the Goalhanger sister podcast, Empire, which I host along with...
me, William Dalrymple. And we are here to tell you about our new series on the founding fathers, the men who made America.
We wanted to look at the men who actually founded the country, who dreamt the dream, who wrote the words upon which a country would be born. What were they like? What made them do what they did? What did they actually believe in? And how did they come to play the role that they did in the American Revolution and the creation of America?
What really interested me about this was the contradictions. I mean, we expect these men to be great figures. We've seen the portraits in the galleries. We know the faces from the banknotes, but they're deeply complex figures. But in that, and in that blend of contradiction and intellectual power and writing genius and curiosity and raw ability, lies the nuance and complexity that allows us to understand them. And the United States is in many ways a reflection of them, their beliefs, their experiences.
These are the men who wrote the Constitution. These are the men who created the federal system. In every way, they are totally fundamental to what American politics looks like today.
It all goes back to this extraordinary group of men.
Yeah, and they have rip-roaring yarns as well, let me tell you. So if you want to know why America is the way it is and who the men were who made it, you can listen by searching Empire wherever you get your podcasts.